And hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Really good to have you along on this last day of May of 2013. Our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community, our state, our region, with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, they are as follows. We'll introduce to you our new state impact education reporter for WLRN. She's a familiar voice, and she's been here for several years helping out with the news product. And we congratulate her officially on her new position with State Impact Florida. Hi, Sammy Mack.
Hey, Phil Latzman.
NPR's national correspondent based in Miami is Greg Allen. He is an original panelist on this program when we started 4 years ago, and he is back with us today. Welcome back, Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Phil.
And also one of our originals who's been with us since the beginning is a longtime South Florida Sun Sentinel columnist Michael Mayo has made the trip down from Fort Lauderdale. Hello, Mr. Mayo.
Always a pleasure, Phil.
And this, of course, is your show, too. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We're emailable at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And we're also tweetable. You can follow us at WLRN or go to our WLRN.org page to participate in a live blog and online discussion that is being curated by our social media editor, Mr. Danny Rivera, who, by the way, had a fine column at WLRN.org about the state of race relations in South Florida in the wake of Urban Beach Weekend. We're going to talk a little bit about that in our next segment, along with the upcoming trial of George Zimmerman in Orlando. A lot of stuff to get to. We're going to start, though, thinking about how issues on this show sort of resonate, especially when it comes to transportation. People get really fired up when it comes to transportation. Now, back in January, we hosted Jeremy Hobson from Marketplace, who sent a tweet complaining about how bad the drivers were in South Florida, and that sparked a conversation that we've been having since about texting while driving, and the statistic that we give out, about 23 times more likely to crash when you are texting and driving. Well, 39 other states have had some texting while driving bans on the books, but up until now, not Florida. That changed this week after Governor Rick Scott signed the texting while driving ban into law. He chose Alonzo and Tracy Morning High School here in North Miami to do the honors, and it's been a long time in coming. Republican Senator Nancy Dietert of Venice has been championing this legislation, for the last 4 years.
It takes a while to get these things done. But bills like this, good bills, are worth it in the end.
But is it really a good bill? Some say the law does not go far enough. It makes texting behind the wheel a secondary offense, so you'd have to be pulled over for something else to be cited, and then first-time offenders would only have to pay a $30 fine. Here's Sergeant Mark Wysocki of the Florida Highway Patrol. He says as long as you're not actually moving, you can still text away.
When your motor vehicle is stationary, stopped, not in motion, not being operated, is not considered a violation of the texting statute.
In addition, when the law goes into effect in October, you can still text in an emergency, use your phone to get directions, among other exceptions. Mike Mayo, is this a law without teeth?
Yeah, it is. In the past, I've written that I call it text ban light because it is so toothless. You know, the main thing is, you know, if a cop sees somebody texting while they're driving, they really can't pull them over unless they do something like weave and swerve lanes, and then they can get them on a improper lane shift or a reckless driving charge. But to me, that's the thing that sticks in my craw. I would like to see it on its own being a offense that because, you know, how many times do we see it every day where somebody who does something stupid, who blows through a stop sign or doesn't start moving on a green light for 10 seconds until you have to start blaring your horn, inevitably they're texting.
And you could still do that because you'd be sitting in a car at a red light or presumably green, but as long as you're stationary, it's okay.
Yeah.
Sammy, you think this changes? And we know driving around Miami, driving around South Florida, it's crazy. We sort of get used to it. Do you think this could change anything about the way we drive in South Florida, this new law?
I mean, we'll see. One of the things that I think is really interesting about this is that there's a provision that it's okay if you're using voice command to text. And we know from research that it is just about as dangerous to be talking into your phone, telling it what to text, as it is to be looking down at your phone, telling it what to text. And we have research that shows that, you know, if what they're going after is safety, that's probably not going to be enough. So You know, we spend a lot of time griping about how terrible the traffic is and how bad the drivers are here. And it's, you know, one of those things that you just look at it and this is why Florida can't have nice things because we drive so poorly.
You're fond of saying that. I know that. One of the other things that it does, it has a provision in there that would let law enforcement subpoena phone records if there's a major accident or death involved. So there's some teeth there. Greg, what do you think about this? I mean, a lot of other states.
The other way on this and say, remember where we're living. This is Florida. This is a state that how many times in the past did this come up and we never really addressed it, never went to it, you know? And so I think that the fact that they passed it in this time is a triumph, personally. And what we've done for the first time is said, this is against the law. Now, you know, of course, it's Florida. All these people are going to ignore it. But, you know, there's a certain amount of people who are not. And at least it sends a signal. And so you can say to your kid, it is against the law, you know, and we start the process. It's like they always say in Washington, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This is good that we passed this law. It's a start.
Well, yeah. I'm afraid, though, that, you know, although it's a start, that they're never going to finish. And that, you know, a lot of the mindset in Tallahassee is that, okay, now we've done something and that's enough. And they, a lot of people up there, for whatever reason, see it as government intrusion, even though we're talking about people on public roadways operating things that have to be licensed and registered through the state.
Former Boca Raton State Representative Irving Schlossberger, he's, I guess, current Boca Raton State Rep, and he's been there for a while. He actually ran on the basis of, I guess, his daughter was killed in a drunk driving accident, if I'm not mistaken, and has based his legislative career on traffic safety. For him, the bill is a disappointment. He says it was gutted by powerful lawmakers from three camps, people who dislike police, people who text and drive themselves, and libertarians.
What happened is it started off with the primary, became a secondary offense. And then, you could text in traffic jams. Well, you could text in red lights. Well, it's only $30 for a... the police can't even confiscate your records to see if you were on the cell phone unless you kill or you seriously injure someone.
So there's that, and there's also the matter of just public safety in general and hospital visits. And I mean, yes, the law is in effect, but I don't think we'll see much of an impact as far as public safety is concerned. Sam, I mean, this is something you track as far as health, as being a former health reporter.
Yeah. I mean, the studies are really mixed on what this kind of law, particularly here where we have so many exemptions to being able to text and drive, what's going to happen. If you look at other states that have done similar laws, research is mixed on whether or not it makes an impact.
You know, I will go back and say I think this is about social pressure and changing social norms. And the way you start talking, I mean, you know, think about seatbelts. I mean, seatbelts should not be in cars. We grew up not wearing them. We had them in cars, didn't use them.
Yeah.
It was a secondary offense. It took years, and they finally made a primary offense. And I think there's more seatbelt use. So I think this is the beginning of a very long process.
I think you're right, Greg.
We asked our members from the Public Insight Network to chime in and help us with some of their responses this week of whether or not this law had any teeth, and we got a bunch of responses. Marcos is on the line with us from Hialeah, who he had a bad experience with someone who was texting while driving. We welcome you to the Florida Roundup. Hi, Marcos.
Hi, Phil.
So tell us what happened.
Well, I was driving eastbound, and I was stopped by the train tracks. And I could see somebody in my rearview mirror, and I watched helplessly as that person hit my car. And I know for a fact that she was texting and driving, and there was nothing that I could do about it.
So do you think this new law does anything to stop people like that doing that behind the wheel?
I welcome the law, because before we didn't have anything, and at least it's a step in the right direction. And in the case where somebody hurt somebody pretty bad, I mean, it could help out to prove in court that that person was sexting. So it's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't necessarily do enough to enforce.
Does it make South Florida better drivers?
I do not believe so. I do not believe so, but I hope that there's some follow-up to this.
Well, there certainly will be. Marcos, thanks very much for your call. Here's another member of the Public Insight Network, Juan from Hallandale Beach, who admits to texting while driving. And honestly, I think we all have done it. Can everybody raise their hand and say they...
Phil, I've gotten emails from you when I know you were on the road.
Okay, everybody.
My editor has a really hilarious email.
I do it when I'm stopped. So.
My editor, she sends out emails that says, sent while texting, sent from my iPhone while driving.
So it's obviously something that's sort of out there as something that people do, and it's people, everyday people that considered to have brain cells do these things, and it's probably, and the other thing with it, you compare this to, is the seatbelt law in Florida, which was a secondary offense up till a few years ago. Did anybody put their seatbelt on in Florida before that law became a primary offense?
Yeah, I think they did. I think, but long, because it only became a primary offense, was it 2 years ago? Fairly recently, and people were widely using it before that. And so I think the law is just part of this larger, societal trend that'll happen,
Well, it's become ingrained. And the thing is, I think we also have to retrain ourselves. These smartphones, they're powerful tools. They become addictive. And every time you hear that chime of a message coming, and we've become these Pavlovian dogs that we can't even wait for 5 minutes. And we really have to, I don't know how we retrain ourselves, maybe just shut the phone off while you're behind the wheel.
Yeah, I remember a study coming out a couple of years ago where somebody had measured the pleasure response in your brain from when you hear that ding from your cell phone. And it rewires the way that you respond to your phone.
We are going to move on, and this continues to be an issue, and we'll continue to cover it. But the other driving issue that is kind of sticking out for Floridians is the issue of red light cameras, because Big Brother is watching in the form of red light cameras. Over 100 Florida municipalities now have them. They generated more than $100 million in revenue last year. Approximately half of that, a little more than half of that, goes to the state. The rest is divided by cities, counties, and the camera companies, and they're estimating this year that those cameras are on pace to generate $120 million. Then we found out that FDOT, Florida Department of Transportation, secretly shortened yellow light times, presumably to ticket more people than they did this a couple of years ago. So are these cameras keeping us safer? I don't personally have anything wrong with people running red lights getting ticketed, but is this the way to do it, Mike?
Now, again, I think it's a case of, when you're talking about the straight-ahead offenders, people that are just blowing through red lights, at 40 miles an hour that cause these horrific T-bone crashes, we all want that to stop, and we all yell at people who blow through red lights so egregiously. But then the other case is it becomes a game of gotcha, especially when it's on these right turn on reds and kind of ticky-tack, especially at intersections where the other cross street has a left turn signal, so you know that there's nobody that's going to be coming from the from the cross street, so you think you have a pretty clear shot, so not everybody comes to a full stop, and then they still end up getting a ticket in the mail 4 weeks later. And right. I know it's in Boca Raton where there's this one really bad intersection where I get complaints all the time, and I've gone to check it out. And that, to me, seems like a money grab.
Aventura, too, is the situation with the rolling red light, people not coming to a full stop.
And the thing, I think they're very unpopular for that right turn on red reason, is what, as Mike said. But the thing that really bugs me about them is the process, how this is done by, private companies who come into a municipality and said, hey, here's a money-making thing. Now, I think municipalities do actually put it in many cases for public safety, but you can't deny the fact that
it's a business.
That people come in as a business, and they do all the work, they install it, they and then the thing that really is galling is that it's actually not even a traffic ticket. It's like a zoning violation, because it has to be processed by the companies, and so it's handled differently in many cases than a regular traffic ticket handled by a cop, and that's created some legal problems.
And how about this? The fine is $158 for abusing or getting caught on a red light camera. The fine for texting and driving and willfully endangering another person's life is $30.
Well, 60 if you do it twice.
60 if you do it twice, then you lose points. And according to the Sun Sentinel, what is the area that has given out the most red light tickets? Now, you guys probably have the answer there, but let everybody think about that for a moment. It is...
You tell me.
It's Fort Lauderdale. You should know. It's your newspaper, right? 19,534 tickets. Boynton Beach is handed out 17,105. If you are going to not get caught, you should go to Hallandale Beach, because in Hallandale, they've only given out about 3,600 of them. That's the fewest of any Florida city equipped.
But they have fewer cameras, too. It all depends on how many intersections you have. And it's, I guess, really the key is, are they doing it for the right turns? And a lot of cities, and I think Fort Lauderdale, to its credit, have really stopped giving those ticky-tack right turns. And, that's one area where I'd like to see the law tweaked even more and made uniform, because some cities, the police won't give you a rolling right on red if you're going less than, let's say, 10 miles an hour, but some cities there's a zero tolerance. And again, you don't know, based on what city you're in, what the standards are.
All right. Well, Steve Ogiello has been very active on this, and he's now joining us. His daughter was a casualty. Allie was a casualty of a driver distracted by texting, and he's been in contact with us as this law has passed through the legislature, and he's now on the line with us. Steve, welcome. So what do you think of this new texting while driving ban in Florida?
Well, I'm pretty happy that we got something passed, because we've been fighting for 5 years now to get a law on the books. But as far as the law, the way it's written, I think it's very weak, and I don't feel that it's going to be any kind of a deterrent.
So what would make this a deterrent in your mind?
Well, first and the most important thing would be to make it a primary offense. I feel if it's a primary offense, more people are going to take notice to it, because they'll be able to be pulled over if they get caught texting. Secondary, the fine needs to be a little bit more than $30, because that's not a deterrent at all. If it was, say, start out with $100 or $150, I think that's going to hit them more in the pocket, and people are going to think twice about trying to get away with doing it. And then the second offense should be at least $500 or possible suspension of license for 6 months. And you got to hit them hard and make them understand that it's dangerous, and it's not them people are worried about, it's the other people around them.
So, Steve, are you going to continue to be an advocate trying to change the law and make it a little bit tougher? Are your efforts going to continue?
Well, of course. I feel that we won a battle, but the war's not over. I remember when the seatbelt law was put into effect, at first it was a secondary offense, mm-hmm. and it was, I believe, $28 fine. And that was changed.
Well, Steve, our condolences again on the death of your daughter. I know it's been a while. I know you've got the cause here, and we've been in touch with you throughout this whole thing, and we will continue to be if anything changes. Thanks very much for your call.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Reintroducing our panel for this hour. Greg Allen is the national correspondent for NPR News, based here in South Florida. Michael Mayo is a columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Sammy Mack is our WLRN State Impact Florida reporter. We're going to talk education with Sammy in a little bit. And your questions are welcome for the panel. We're going to ask the question, sensitive question, of what does the Trayvon Martin case and Urban Beach Weekend say about race relations in South Florida? Is it still an issue for us? So you can chime in on that when we have that discussion coming up in just a moment. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. We're also very accessible on social media. We have a live blog being hosted by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, right now at WLRN.org. We're also all tweetable, our WLRN call sign, and also I'm at Phil Latzman. Mike, your Twitter handle, sir?
At Hey Mike Mayo.
And Sammy?
At Sammy Mack.
Easy enough. Greg Allen, you are new to Twitter, but you're on there.
G Allen NPR.
So key motions ruled on this week in the murder trial of George Zimmerman, accused of killing the Miami Gardens teen Trayvon Martin last year in Sanford. A hearing was scheduled for this morning concerning the media and what information can be released about jurors, but that was postponed indefinitely. And now George Zimmerman's legal team is saying that they need more money to defend him with this trial set to go next month in Sanford. Jury selection notices have been mailed for the case. 500 potential jurors have been notified, and the judge says she hopes to select a jury in a week. The defense says it may take a month. Another pretrial hearing this week, a judge ruled that the second-degree murder trial will proceed as scheduled. Zimmerman's defense attorneys had asked for a delay to go over newly discovered evidence, and they also ruled the jurors will not hear that Martin was in Sanford on the night of his death because he'd been suspended from his South Florida high school. They also, Greg, and you've been doing coverage on this for NPR and will do this summer, won't hear about his past marijuana use or history of fighting, at least during the opening arguments.
Yeah, but on that one, I think that Zimmerman's attorney, Mark O'Mara, thinks that actually the marijuana use will come in because they're going to introduce the toxicology report and they're going to question the toxicologist. And you know, and the toxicology did show that Trayvon Martin had THC in his system. I mean, the amount is somewhat in dispute and not clear, so which is the active ingredient in marijuana. So I think that O'Mara thinks that the discussion of some discussion of Trayvon Martin's use of marijuana will be pertinent, will come up in the trial, but not in opening arguments, you say.
And speaking of O'Mara, he told the judge that Martin's past is intertwined with the behavior that led to the deadly confrontation.
All of that fits in squarely to what the defense is going to present as the reason why George Zimmerman was put in the position where he had to act in self-defense. We can't act in a vacuum as to who Mr. Trayvon acted as that night.
Martin family attorney Benjamin Crump responded. He spoke after the hearing on Tuesday.
Trayvon Martin did not have a gun. Trayvon Martin did not get out the car to chase anybody. Trayvon Martin did not shoot and kill anybody. Trayvon Martin is not on trial.
The circuit judge Deborah Nelson also ruled against sequestering the jury pool and against taking jurors to the scene of the shooting, reasoning that both ideas are unrealistic. And the jury selection again begins on June 10th. Mike, you know, the question sort of the thread of this conversation is how does this case sort of affect the conversation about race that we've been having in South Florida and in Florida in general?
Well, again, the crux of this case is formed by a volunteer neighborhood watch person, George Zimmerman, riding around in his car in a gated community and seeing a young black male who he didn't recognize, and then given the context of apparently there had been some other robberies or burglaries in the neighborhood in the past few weeks, and I guess what the description of the alleged perpetrator was that he might have been black. So he was going off that. Again, if it was a young white kid walking back from a store with Skittles, would George Zimmerman have stopped? I don't know. I can't get in his head. But that is the question that everybody's wondering. And then, of course, it escalated. But, you know, beyond race, this also trial is going to end up being about the Stand Your Ground law and whether or not George Zimmerman may have been overzealous in getting out of the car. The Stand Your Ground law would give him the right to use deadly force if he felt that he gets into a violent physical confrontation where he felt his own life was threatened.
And, you know, I was in Orlando, I guess, in April for the Associated Press Awards, and the speakers there were O'Mara and Benjamin Crump, Mark O'Mara and Benjamin Crump. And O'Mara, and I think I mentioned this on the show about a month ago, said this case is going to divide us. He pretty much put it out there and said this is going to be harmful. Greg, do you agree?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it has been very divisive up to now. And I think O'Mara makes the case that he thinks that the media has played a role in actually dividing us and using it and presenting stuff that he feels was unfair about Zimmerman certainly I think, and he's doing his best now to bring out information that some people will think is unfair about Trayvon Martin. I mean, and when people challenged O'Mara on how, you know, there's a series of text messages that have been introduced into evidence. We'll see if they get into trial, which show, you know, Trayvon Martin talking about marijuana use, talking about guns, talking about his history of being involved in some fights, and how he'd been on, how he'd gotten beaten in one, how he did well in another. And that was all material that O'Mara would like to introduce into the trial if possible. He says he won't bring it in himself, only if it's necessary to answer things. But then that gets the issue: are we making Trayvon Martin? Are we? It's not about him being his actions; it's about George Zimmerman's actions. You know, a lot of people don't like the fact that it's putting Trayvon Martin on trial.
Well, how do we avoid this being a complete circus this summer? I mean, is there any avoiding it? I mean, you're going up to cover it. You're not necessarily the circus, but that's part of the story, too.
There is an insatiable demand for this material. I mean, Jodi Arias' trial got so much attention, and why do we care about that one? This trial, actually, I think, has greater interest because of the facts, the matter of an unarmed teenager who happened to be staying with some friends, and it was identified as suspicious, and then we had what happened, you know? So I don't know if there's any way to avoid it, to be honest.
I wish there was a way we could just blot out all mentions of race on both sides of this trial, because to me, it's fascinating on its own, of the whole stand your ground law, and can somebody just get out and confront somebody who's just walking down the street, and then if that person who's just walking down the street takes offense and then actually gets into a confrontation, then you're saying that person basically can be killed under Florida law. But again, you add in the racial component, where so many people who are black who, you know, describe the phenomenon of being stopped or pulled over for just driving while black or walking while black because they're automatically seen as suspicious in certain places. And that's why this has resonated so deeply among minority communities.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That's Michael Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Sammy Mack from State Impact Florida also with us, as well as Greg Allen from NPR News. And that transitions us into the conversation about Urban Beach Weekend. A lot has been made of that event here in South Florida for the past decade or so. Another Urban Beach Week has come to a close on Miami Beach. There were smaller crowds than in years past. Still tens of thousands of people made it to South Beach for the party. Business owners, some of them say the road closures and heavy police presence kept customers away over the holiday weekend. Police made about 340 arrests, the minor offenses. But Sammy Mack, you spent some time actually on Miami Beach watching what was going on, and it seemed pretty quiet.
Yeah, I went out Memorial Day morning around 5 o'clock in the morning to get that sort of crossover between where the party kids are winding down and everybody else is gearing up.
A great piece you heard on WLRN this week.
Thanks, yeah. And it's a fun time to be out there because it's kind of this magic hour. But I was struck when I was driving in by the fact that I saw way more police than I saw partygoers. And in talking to folks anecdotally, a lot of people had that experience. And the other thing that I noticed is just walking around all of these road closures, police and private security forces everywhere, these sidewalks that had the gates in front of them or the little fences in front of them so that you can't cross the street except at certain points, reminded me of preparing for Mardi Gras. I used to live in New Orleans, and it looked like crowd control for Mardi Gras, except that draws like a million people, and this at its peak drew 250,000. So it was kind of interesting to see, and it was just sort of empty.
Yeah, and this is an event. I mean, everybody talks about it. The white flight, if you will, from the beach on that day, because people think that there's going to be all these minorities, blacks, people that they don't know coming to the beach. And we talked about how this has a racial tinge to it. I mean, there's no avoiding it. It's there. But do we sort of make a bigger deal out of it than we really need to, Mike Mayo?
Well, I think, again, if we filter out the race, I think what we're seeing here now in Miami is you have these a large crowd of young partygoers. And now the city is saying, do we really want this image? Do we need this? Maybe we should crack down on it, have a heavy police presence, and we'll scare everybody off. And whether it's black in the case of Urban Beach Weekend or white in the case of the old spring break in Fort Lauderdale in the 1980s, you know, eventually the message was delivered where you had all these white kids coming in, you know, back then it was college kids, but predominantly, right, white. And they would come and get drunk and do their bikini, you know, the belly flop dances and the bikini contests. And eventually it got out of control, and the city decided we want a crackdown. So they just started throwing lots of kids in jail for public indecency or, you know, urination or whatever. And then eventually the message was delivered and they stopped coming.
I don't know if Miami Beach would want to go that way, though, because this is a different town. You know, it's Fort Lauderdale I think it's larger, and it's certainly got a lot more going for it besides the tourism and the beach and the partying. That's what Miami Beach is all about. The way we sell it to the world here. So I don't think that is going to be the way we're going to go here.
And then there's more developments. If you remember, a couple of years ago, there were shootings on Miami Beach from the Urban Beach Weekend, a fatal shooting 2 years ago. Apparently, the crucial tape recordings were not destroyed at all. After all, the conversations between police on the scene and dispatchers recorded during Urban Beach Week, right after the officers unleashed a barrage of 116 gunshots that killed motorist Raymond Harise and wounded four others. Although a police spokesman said earlier the tapes had been destroyed during routine housekeeping, Miami Beach Police Chief Ray Martinez says they still exist and they may be turned over to lawyers representing families of the dead man and the wounded survivors. He says he'll now release those recordings. He says, though, it may violate rules to do it and could subject him to criminal charges. So, again, the idea that the police are out there and there's a lot of police and there's the idea that somebody could actually fire 116 shots, one of these police officers,
I think he was hit by 16. So that means 100 shots went awry, which gives you some pause about, you know, if this is how police shoot weapons, then we have, you know, with the stand your ground law and how many concealed carry weapons we have out there, the actual chance of hitting your target are not always that great when the adrenaline's pumping.
Shots. If something like that had happened during spring break and it was a white college student that was the subject of 116 rounds of gunfire, you know, there would be an outcry over it. And I guess, you know, this is why there's an outcry over this case, mm-hmm. too. And, you know, but it all goes back to nothing ever good happens at 4 a.m. And so that's
words
why
to live
those
by.
Of us who ever, you know, reach a certain age, we just kind of hunker down and say, you know, let's call it quits at 1.
I am witness to 4 a.m. in South Florida, and I can tell you, well, there are some good things it has. Very quiet, very serene. I can tell you that much.
Unless you're nice jogging thing. To see the sunset, sunrise, yeah. I don't know.
All right. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Not early riser Michael Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel with us. Sammy Mack, who is an early riser with State Impact Florida. In fact, she rises early to report on education news in Florida, and we're going to talk to her about what she's working on with State Impact Florida when we come back. Greg Allen from NPR is also with us. We're going to also tell you about hurricane season. Hey, it's here. Are we ready? It's been 8 years since we've been hit by a hurricane in Florida, believe it or not. We're coming back in just a moment. Yes, we are back. It's the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Phil Latzman, Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel, Greg Allen from NPR, Sammy Mack from State Impact Florida and WLRN. And as long as we're with you, Sammy, it's been a year of enormous changes in education policy in the state, almost too much to keep up with. I mean, we've been reporting on all kinds of things that are coming from Tallahassee, coming locally. So we brought in Sammy. She is our brand new State Impact Florida reporter to help us sort things out. So you've been studying this now and preparing to report on it. What are some of the more significant changes that are coming to public schools?
It's been a really big year for education policy in Florida. The state changed high school graduation requirements and created two different high school diploma degree tracks. Kids took the second to last FCAT this year, and it's going to be replaced by something. The state is looking into a replacement standardized test. The University of Florida got the go-ahead to launch an exclusively online bachelor degree program. And then there's the one-time teacher pay raise. So what we wanted to know, and the story that I'm working on for Monday, is what, with all of this, was really learned this year?
I dissected a frog, and I learned more about the organs in the body. I learned a little bit more of, like, math, for example. Like, we're starting a little bit of algebra. And, like, reading, I have had more, like, my vocabulary has been increasing.
That's 12-year-old Shayla Avila. That's one of my favorite responses to that question so far. Shayla is in sixth grade at George Washington Carver Middle School. And you can hear the rest of that story on Monday. But I also spoke to some teachers and policymakers about their big lessons this year. And one of the things that keeps coming up again and again is the role of the Common Core, which are these new standards in testing, or new standards that are coming in that will kind of change the way we do testing. And with that, the role of technology in the classroom. Florida has this mandate that by 2015, half of all instructional material in classrooms will have to be digital. And there are a lot of questions about how to make that work. One model that this group, there's a working group that's advising policymakers in the state, is looking at is a one-to-one model, which would put one computer for every student in a classroom. And the research is a little bit mixed on whether or not it makes a big impact on standardized test scores, but we do know that there is evidence that it can impact all sorts of cognitive function and critical thinking skills. And anecdotally, one mother that I spoke to at Holmes Elementary School in Liberty City has been blown away by what's happened in the one-to-one classroom with her kid. This is Linda Forbes. Her son is a first grader.
And since he's been using a computer in school, it helped him out a lot with his reading, his math. He's actually on a third grade reading level right now. As a mother, to see that my child is learning through technology is... I'm lost for words, basically.
Yeah, so in the meantime, there are still a lot of questions. The technology isn't cheap. There's going to be a lot of tech requirements on whatever technology is used related to the Common Core lesson plans and how kids get tested on it. And then there's the issue of what happens when you have a digital classroom, but a room full of students who are going back to homes that may or may not have computers or access to the internet.
Yeah, Mike, you and I both have students in public schools in South Florida, and we hear...
I have two also.
And, yeah. And you do too, right, too, Greg. So we have parents here, but what do you think these changes will be felt, and are they for the better?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, you know, like this, when you hear these words from this mother, it is powerful, and that computers can be a really powerful learning tool. But there is such a wide gap, the technology gap, of based on what your income and your, you know, background is. And, you know, my daughter, when she comes home, you know, she has all the gadgets. She has computers that she's on. She goes to these math sites to play games with math and all these things. But what about people who don't have that when they go home? And so we need that in schools. But on the other hand, you know, and now we have this push towards virtual learning at all levels, which... You know, it can also be wonderful for certain students, but I'm also a little bit concerned about, are we going to lose our humanity? Are we going to lose the socialization skills that if we just become a nation of, you know, computer nerds and learning on computers and just dealing with computers, what about, you know, talking to each other and dealing with authority figures like teachers and principals?
Greg, are we up to date?
Well, this whole thing with the online virtual learning, I've become somewhat of a skeptic on, having viewed it firsthand through my kids and, mm-hmm. and what's going on in throughout Florida. I mean, this is basically... It's inevitable. It's good, if you think of it that way. It's good. It's inevitable, but it's also the way it's being done here. It's basically outsourcing jobs, right? I mean, that's part of what this is about, and I think it's part of what the legislature is looking at, is a way to save money on that we spend on education
and to private for-profit firms,
right.
That
exactly.
could be connected,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
then these firms that do the virtual education are connected through their lobbyists, and we've seen the bit of a scandal with the online the tutoring that's gone
right.
on for that, and so it's another way to get take public money and to send it out for bids, and you got people getting their hands into the till. And I've seen it play out with my kids, and in some cases they get really good attention from their online teachers who might be in Massachusetts, but in some cases, you know, they don't get all the attention they want, and you have to wait to get them to call you back.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't get
that
you know that the attention that you get from a teacher. So and it's hard for the parents to be involved sometimes. So I'm not sold on it yet. By any means.
And you talk to anybody who has been involved in successful models for online learning, and they will all tell you, like, you cannot just put a camera in a classroom and videotape something and expect that a kid is going to get a lesson out of it. It really needs to make sense with the technology that you're using. You need to have support networks so that students don't miss out on the kinds of interactions that foster learning in a classroom setting. You have to create sort of an ecosystem around it to make it work really well. And you have to get everybody's buy-in, too. When you just have, you know, like throw a computer at a kid and hope that it works, that doesn't work. We know that doesn't work.
Sammy, also the other major education news this year at Tallahassee was the teacher raises. It finally got resolved, not in the way that Governor Scott necessarily wanted to across the board, but there is $480 million set aside. There's some questions, especially in the larger districts, Miami-Dade being one of them, about how that is going to be distributed and whether there's going to be enough to give teachers raises.
Yeah, I love PolitiFact Florida fact-checked. Rick Scott went around saying that everybody's going to get a $2,500 bonus, and it turns out that, according to PolitiFact Florida, that's kind of half true. There's going to be money for people who their performance evaluations are good or excellent, and maybe not all teachers are going to get that money. And then you have districts that are saying, you know, looking at who qualifies for this, we may not have enough money for everybody to get it. And so there's a lot of question around that, and people aren't even going to see that money until 2014.
So yet to be determined.
Hopefully by October of 2014, right, for Rick Scott's sake, since this, I think, is a pretty big election year ploy for him for his reelection prospects.
Yeah, no question. All right, now you're listening to the Florida Roundup. Mike Mayo, Sammy Mack, Greg Allen, Phil Latzman, good to have you along. We are about to enter another hurricane season, like it or not. The 2013 Atlantic hurricane season officially begins on Saturday. Forecasters are predicting another active season, and while storm predictions may be improving, they remain inexact. National Hurricane Center Director Rick Knapp says the cone of uncertainty remains uncertain.
The accuracy of our track forecasts has been improving steadily over the last couple of decades, but I want to emphasize that problem is not solved.
And in the aftermath of a Superstorm Sandy last year, which devastated parts of the East Coast and left coastal areas flooded and eroded, NAB says another issue yet to be solved involves how forecasters predict storm surge.
Storm surge and hurricane or tropical storm force winds, history teaches us in some recent events, don't always occur in the same place in the same time. Storm surge needs its own watch and warning, and we're headed in that direction.
And Greg Allen, you, in fact, have filed something for NPR that will air tomorrow during Weekend Edition Saturday on this very issue of predicting storm surge.
Right. On the Hurricane Center, they're coming out. They hope to come out later this year with new storm surge maps that they'll be using for the showing to the public. And they're already getting this information out to the emergency managers. They've redone the evacuation zone maps here in Miami-Dade County. And if anybody hasn't checked those, they should check them before the hurricane season, because almost everything south of 8th Street now is in a possible evacuation zone. But you know, some of them are
know your zones.
I mean, and what they've done is they've reassessed it, learning from Sandy and how big some of these storms can be and how much storm surge can come in. But by 2015, the Hurricane Center will be issuing storm surge warnings separate from hurricane warnings. Right now, when they say something's like a Category 3 hurricane, it has nothing to do with storm surge. And when they do hurricane warnings, it has nothing to do with storm surge. They're going to break that out totally separately by 2015.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says we can expect 13 to 20 named storms. That's above average, about half of them predicted to become hurricanes. Where they'll go, of course, we don't know, but we do know that the lack of the Pacific weather pattern known as El Nino, which can suppress storms in the Atlantic, is not there this year, and that's why forecasters say it could produce stronger and more frequent hurricanes this season. Now, this is amazing when you think about it, Mike, that it's been 8 years since a hurricane hit Florida, and I guess
Of 2005, yeah, Wilma, Hurricane Wilma, which for a one borderline 1-2 storm.
Well, they upgraded it to a 3.
Did
since
they?
Then.
I
yeah.
missed that.
Yeah, they
okay,
did.
Well,
it was the last Category 3 to hit the United States.
No wonder why all the power got knocked out for so long.
That explains a lot.
No, but you know, still, Max went. Well, okay, they're saying it's a 3, but it was, you know, obviously it was a widely felt storm, and luckily we haven't really felt much since then. But we've learned a lot in these years, and number one is that hurricanes are not just a southern, southeastern phenomenon anymore. Now the whole Atlantic coast, all the way up to New England, is worried about a storm, rightfully so. And then we also see that you don't have to be right in the middle of a storm to get a devastating effect. Last August, we had, I guess it was Isaac, that spawned these torrential downpours in Palm Beach County, even though the center of the storm was all the way up in the Gulf of Mexico, hundreds of miles away. And we had 20, 25-inch downpours off this kind of crazy band that formed in the aftermath. So, again, you can't focus on the center of a storm, and geographical boundaries are getting erased. So basically, every storm is different. Every storm season is different. All it takes is one powerful one to ruin your whole decade. Just ask New Orleans that after Katrina. And we all have to be prepared and be on guard.
You lived through that, Sammy, the Hurricane Katrina.
Well, I lived there right afterwards. I wasn't actually there for the storm. But man, I tell you what, that city will be recovering for another decade. It's really, you're right, you live with it for 10 years.
Yeah. Wilma in 2005, as we mentioned, the last time that a major Category 3 or higher storm hit the U.S. mainland. That is the longest such stretch in the history of weatherkeeping.
Oh, and just can I add one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, because now after the recent, you know, tornado devastation in Oklahoma, which was more widespread damage than we ever thought, imaginable from a little twister, I mean, are we going to start this conversation about maybe national disaster insurance again? Because, again, every area has its own perils, and if there's a way to pool this risk a little more effectively so that we all don't get hammered with rising insurance rates, you know, is there a way to do that? And, again, the discussion in Washington invariably stops because some of these Midwestern states say, well, we don't want to pay to subsidize your hurricane insurance. They go, well, I'll say, how about now? Maybe we'll help you subsidize your tornado relief.
Yeah, there's a lot of Oklahoma politicians who voted against the Sandy relief package that are now going to benefit from that. That story was on Morning Edition
and
today.
And I think they would probably still oppose the national catastrophic insurance, but maybe things will change.
So have we sort of become complacent here? I mean, that question gets asked every year, and as we get further and further away from an event where some people obviously weren't here to witness Wilma or 20 years ago Andrew. But are we ready? Is our guard up in case this happens? What do you think, Sam? You're shaking your head.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so, and I think that's a problem everywhere. Can you really be ready for something like that? Individually, sure, there are people who are prepared and have plans, mm-hmm. but it's one of those things. I don't think you can really be prepared for it until it happens.
But I will say that I don't think there's anywhere in the country that's better prepared for a hurricane than South Florida. I mean, you know, you've traveled around. I mean, there's no one has building codes like, and this all came in post-Andrew, you know, the concrete block, this double strapping. I mean,
Miami-Dade County has.
Miami-Dade County. Certainly, I mean, things could be bad. We've got a big storm surge, you know, but.
And even our evacuation zones for storm surges are pretty well mapped out, and people take it seriously down here, as opposed to the Northeast.
Yeah, as far as the top-down planning goes, yeah, I think that's totally right. But you have so many people who live here. It's such a transient place that I'm sure there's a large swath of the population that just doesn't appreciate what that planning is for.
One more thing. Quickly, most places in the country don't know what hurricane shutters are. New Orleans, they don't have hurricane shutters to this day. North Carolina, many homes don't. So just think about that.
All right, now the other issue, speaking of hurricane shutters, goes to Citizens Insurance, and this will be the first year. I think you and I both are, now I'm off Citizens now. They put me to a private policy. I don't know.
Oh, you went with it. You didn't opt out.
I went
you
with did, it. I okay. went, I think, a lot of my...
Did you have an option?
My insurance agent advised me to do the policy private insurance, but I don't know what I'm going to be paying.
Okay. I will talk to you more about this afterwards, but you know, this is
some bad news is coming there, but this is the first year people will be without Citizens. Some people who were taken off the of Citizens now have private insurance. Mike, you've written some about this.
Well, yeah, and it's this very aggressive effort to shed policies and place them back into the private market, but I think the case that we're finding is a lot of these insurers, these private insurers, they're not the big companies or even their subsidiaries. They're these kind of recent upstarts that nobody really knows if they have the ability to weather big storms, how they're going to deal with it, and whether it's this Heritage company that just got this $52 million kind of bonus payout that has been shown to be politically connected. And then I'm looking into another company down here that's based, it's called Weston Insurance Company, that just basically they just were licensed last December, and they got offloaded all these Citizens policies, and now they've never gone out and sold a policy on their own. It's just everything that's been offloaded to them from Citizens, and they've gotten all these inducements to do it. And, you know, I don't know if they're any more trustworthy or if they can have the ability to withstand a big storm. And they can just go bankrupt, and then they still leave the state catastrophe fund holding the bag. So, you know, I don't know if this effort is going to make it any better. But all I know is for the consumer, whereas we used to have a choice to stay with Citizens if we got one of these private companies saying we're going to be taking over your policy, that's no longer the case under this new law. Starting next January, when this clearinghouse comes into effect, basically, when it comes time for your renewal, if you're a Citizens customer like me, and if they go out, if your agent says, oh, we have a private insurer that is willing to give you the same coverage at the same price as Citizens, you have to go with that new company. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of any other product where a consumer doesn't have a choice. I mean, I don't have a choice now because nobody else will write me a policy besides the state-run Citizens. But I'm a little leery of being forced into a private company that I don't have any relationship with and that I might not want trust. I might want to stay with Citizens, but I can't any longer under this new provision.
Well, I don't even know what I'm going to be paying, and I think my insurance comes up in about a month and a half, so I'll
good luck
keep
with
you
that.
Tuned on that. Mike, also you wrote about an amendment drive for medical marijuana in Florida this week. Quickly, what's been the response to that?
Well, I don't know.
A lot of response?
Yeah. Some people think it's a pipe dream, so to speak.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, we have this whole torrent of states, you know, 20 and counting, that where marijuana is legal. So, you know, there is an effort where it's seen as a compassionate alternative to traditional medicine, especially for older people that have some conditions that can be helped.
All right, so we didn't get to the Miami Heat. Everybody's in a good mood today. Of course, they're up 3-2, and the game 6 is tomorrow night. NBA Finals could start next week, and maybe we'll talk more about that on the show. But the last thing is, what should Miami-Dade County do with the $2 million left over from the Miami Dolphins that paid for the failed referendum, Mike?
The election that never was held.
The election
$2 million now sitting around. Yeah. You know what Miami-Dade should do with it? use it to throw the heat parade. We could have open bars, too, maybe.
That's assuming there will be a parade, Mike.
Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah. We're all assuming that. So, Greg, you had another good
suggestion. Well, I think that it could be used for some kind of property tax relief. And as Mike was reminding us, the Dolphins are always asking every year to have the stadium not pay their real estate tax there. It is their money, after all, folks.
Yeah. Well, when's our next public radio fund drive?
Very good idea. Thank you, Sammy. That was the best one. All right, that does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, May 31st, 2013. Sammy Mack is our State Impact Florida reporter. We look forward to hearing her material. A Monday, a report on WLRN. Mike Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel has a column coming out Sunday, right?
Yes.
Another more yes, pearls of wisdom. Greg Allen's got his hurricane report this weekend. He'll be covering the Trayvon Martin case. Thank you all for being with us. We are produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zucker. And this week, also produced by Marva Hinton, who really helped us out. Thanks, Marva. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, social media editor, Danny Rivero, Peter J. Meritz, Dan Gretsch, and Paul Leary at the controls. Thank you. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.